You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Every episode of Table Talk features visionaries from across the food industry and explores the latest innovations and wild ideas that are going to change our world. We like to dig deep and we like to question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Now brace yourselves, because today on Table Talk we're going to explore the science behind the hangover. We're recording this episode 2 weeks before Christmas 2021, and despite the boom in the alcohol-free drink sector, let's be honest, an ocean of alcohol will be drunk up and down the country in the coming days, swiftly followed the next morning by a murky sea of regret. But why do we get hangovers? Is there a cure? And could synthetic alcohol be on the verge of changing that and thereby transforming the entire drinks industry? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by somebody that I've admired for years. He's possibly still best known as the man who in 2009 was sacked as the government's chief drug advisor after explaining that ecstasy and LSD were less dangerous than alcohol, and that taking ecstasy was no more dangerous than horse riding. The Home Secretary claimed that he was dismissed because he cannot be both a government advisor and a campaigner against government policy. A classic case of a government not wanting to hear the truth? Surely not. My guest is, of course, David Nutt, Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology and Director of the Centre for Psychedelic Research in the Division of Brain Science, Imperial College London. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Stefan. Great to be on your show.
Ah, fantastic to have you. Now, okay, so we're talking about hangovers. Now, people's view of hangovers is often guided by comedy tropes. They're often seen as funny, slightly guilty problems, something that proves that you're capable of having a good time. But they can have a huge impact on people's lives and the world in general. What's your relationship? Before we start talking about the nuts and bolts of this, what's your relationship with drink and with hangovers? Is it academic or is it personal?
Well, it's both, obviously. I mean, it's hard to go through student life, particularly as a junior doctor, without drinking far too much and without having hangovers. I've had many times, even in my, occasionally in my 30s, but certainly in my teens and 20s, I have vowed never to drink again.
Yeah,
it usually lasts about 24 hours. But I have had some stellar hangovers. The most famous one I might share with you was that, yeah, I was 18. I was just gone up to Cambridge, and because I was a scholar, I got invited to one of the big feasts, the giant feast, you know, the sort of 11 course feasts with stunning wine. And as they all got up to retreat to take the brandy or the whiskey, I couldn't stand. I really, really struggled. And yes, that hangover was quite memorable the next morning.
But there we go. We're talking about this concept as something that's sort of funny. It's a rite of passage. It's a sort of bravery. And yet it's a problem. Do you still drink alcohol? And if so, what's your favourite drink?
Yeah, I still drink alcohol, although I am moving towards my own cocktails, which I'll talk about later. But yeah, I suppose I've become more and more of a wine drinker as I've got older. I obviously still like a beer on a hot summer's afternoon, and maybe a little single malt just to be sure before I go to bed.
First of all, let's discuss the anatomy of a hangover. What is a hangover, and why do we get them?
Well, we get them because we drink too much. That's the easy answer. What they're caused by is still a bit of a mystery. I mean, when you look at the economic costs of a whole range of different illnesses, and you look at the research investment in different illnesses, hangovers have got to be the least researched, most expensive, economically damaging phenomenon in the UK. It's estimated that the opportunity costs, the lost work opportunities from hangover, cost the country, more than the total costs of drink-related damage, such as cirrhosis and hypertension, and the policing costs put together. So it's over £10 billion a year in terms of lost opportunities from hangover.
And the lack of research, is that because, well, I guess the people making this stuff don't really want to curb their sales? Or is that a little bit too murky an approach to it?
Yeah, I think it is a fundamental question. And it's quite a politically laden question. It's also quite challenging, because where if the question is a hangover an illness? And there have been unfortunate instances in the USA where people have worked on hangover treatments and then fallen foul of the FDA because they were said to be making medical claims without a medical license. And until hangover is defined as an illness, I don't think there will be a systematic attempt to try to find treatments for hangover, frankly.
That's bizarre. I mean, so it's not considered a pathology at all. The inability to function and the pain involved, but it's still not an illness.
And it becomes a little bit of a circular argument. I mean, illnesses tend to be defined, at least in part, by having interventions. And of course, we don't have any good interventions, but a lot of painkillers, a lot of paracetamol and ibuprofen are sold to deal with the pain of the hangover. But as I say, targeting hangover as a treatment has proved rather challenging in terms of regulatory requirements as well as just the science. So, my own view, of course, it's an illness in the same way as breaking your legs an illness. It's something you've done, probably through inappropriate behaviour, which does warrant an intervention. And the economic value of intervening with hangovers would be enormous.
Drinking causes a range of problems from infertility, elevated likelihood of developing certain cancers. And yet, alcohol, it's been around for, we assume, something like 10,000 years. I've travelled making documentaries to some of the poorest places on the planet, and everyone, even if you're in the middle of the roughest refugee camp, people are brewing alcohol. They will save a little part of the grain that they're given as rations, as emergency rations and things like that, and they will brew an alcohol. Everyone has found a way to brew this stuff. It's really important. Before we sort of delve into the other parts of how it all works, are there upsides to alcohol? We know that it makes us feel quite nice. We do it quite a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't have existed for 10,000 years if it didn't have some positive benefits. I mean, if you go back to the very beginning, there are two theories as to why humans decided to settle down and stop being nomads and end up basically growing wheat or barley. One of them was that you could make bread, and the other is you could make beer. And I think it's quite an interesting argument, which, one or other of those is a staple diet of modern society.
That's right. It's a great reason to stay in one place, because then you can make this stuff.
Well, that's right. You can make it, and of course, you can store it. And beer probably came before wine, but wine probably came relatively soon after. And the second, I think, we have to say, why is alcohol the most popular drug? And it's always been the most popular, because alcohol gives you something that most other drugs don't, which is sociability. It is the ultimate social drug. It's the drug which brings humans together in social groups.
I just want to nip in here to say that if you're enjoying this episode, there's another one you might really enjoy. We did a great introduction to this area, exploring the magic of ethanol and how the low and no alcohol industry are discovering alternatives to that amazing compound. It's called The Growth of Alcohol-Free Drinks. You can find it on the website. While you're there, why not explore the whole archive? It's a real treasure trove of everything food industry related, and it's at foodmatterslive.com. Now, back to David. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of the experience of drinking. There are lots of elements involved in going to a pub, for instance. So I wonder if you could walk me through the experience in terms of, so tell me what's happening psychologically and physiologically from when I cross the threshold going into the pub until the end of my third pint.
As you go towards your favourite drinking hole, your brain immediately, before you even cross the threshold, your brain is getting ready to adapt to whatever you're going to give. Now, your brain has generally learned how much you're going to drink. And for people who go and get very drunk, their brains are beginning to switch into the I'm going to keep you alive mode before you even touch a drop. And we can measure this. You can see that things like their heart rate begins to go up, their adrenaline starts to flow before they get to the first drink. And then, of course, the reason their body's adapting is as soon as you drink alcohol, the first thing that happens, of course, is you taste it. And for most of us, it's an acquired taste. The knowledge that actually the bitterness of the hops actually is going to predict you're going to have a fun time in 10 minutes. So the taste goes straight into your brain. The taste system, your smell system, straight into the front part of the brain, which is where you make decisions. So as soon as you've got that, you know, your brain is ready then. It knows alcohol's going down. It goes down your gullet, into your stomach, into your blood, and then into your liver. And then in the liver, something very important happens, which is that some of the alcohol is broken down into acetaldehyde. Now, acetaldehyde is what makes you flush. So when you start to feel a bit warm and you begin to sweat a bit and you begin to get that sort of sensation in your cheeks, that's the acetaldehyde being released. What really happens, and the reason most of us drink, is because we then get a hit in the brain. And that is alcohol getting into the brain, getting into the parts of the brain. Well, it gets everywhere in the brain, but it particularly targets one of the neurotransmitters in the brain called GABA. And GABA is the natural calming transmitter in the brain. It's the transmitter that keeps the brain in equilibrium. And when we get anxious because GABA isn't working very well. And so alcohol kind of pushes GABA, gives GABA a bit of a boost, and it puts us back into the state we want to be in. So the right level of GABA is necessary to have the optimal level of tranquility and sociability, etc. And that is where we start to get the pleasure. We start to become interested in other people, more relaxed. We start to chat. And then, of course, an interesting feedback happens. Once you start to chat to other people, look them in the eye and they start to respond positively to you, you get more positive. And for a while, that's great. And as long as you stick to one or two units of alcohol, then it's generally pretty good. But because alcohol is a very weird drug, it's because it's a very small molecule. And eventually, if you keep pushing the dose up, it'll start interacting with a whole range of other neurotransmitter receptors. And the one that's really problematic is when it starts to work on a brain system called glutamate. Now, glutamate is the on-off switch of the brain. Everything you're hearing, everything you're seeing, everything you're remembering of what I've said is driven by the glutamate system. It's the on-off switch of the brain. And when you get blood alcohol levels about twice the driving limit, you begin to block glutamate. And that's when people start to have blackouts. They can't remember things because without glutamate, you can't lay down a memory. And of course, that's when people begin to get particularly disinhibited because they can't remember proper behavior.
Which brings us on to the hangover, which is, I mean, is it a useful evolutionary tool to curb excessive drinking? You know, you wake up with a hangover, you should make the connection and go, all right, I drank a lot, I feel crap, I shouldn't do that. But it doesn't seem to work for most people because we do it again. You know, I've had many hangovers and I still drink. What's going on?
Interesting question. I'm going to answer it in different ways. So I used to run the alcohol research ward at National Institute of Health in Washington. And I interviewed every patient. We would bring in probably 3 or 4 alcoholics a week. We detoxified them and we studied their brains and tried to work out why they were alcoholics. So I interviewed, over the course of the 2 years I was there, many hundreds of alcoholics. And I always asked them 2 key questions. Can you remember your first drink? But the other question was, of course, I asked them was, do you get hangovers? And almost none of them had hangovers. So that kind of helps explain. If you don't suffer the consequences, then really, you know, what's there not to like about being drunk all the time, other than you spend a lot of money and you end up being admitted to hospital. But I think hangovers do have a deterrent effect. And the other piece of evidence we have, which is studies of the geographic spread of drinking, is the fact that the Chinese, who have a particular variant of the gene that breaks down acetaldehyde, so they can't break it down as much, they get the Chinese flushing reaction. And it is absolutely clear that if you get sick when you drink from acetaldehyde, you drink less, they have less cirrhosis, and they have less alcohol dependence. Not none. So there's clearly being ill on alcohol is a deterrent to drinking. And most people, you know, when they get into their 30s and 40s, begin to at least moderate their behavior. So they're not having a hangover when the kids are getting them up at 5 a.m. So I think there is some deterrent value.
Now, every year there's an article in The New Scientist which says how to reduce the effects of hangovers. I mean, you know, it's a staple of journalists around this time of year, certainly for New Year, when when people are feeling really rough. But let's bring this on to synthetic alcohol. Actually, first of all, rather than me saying anything about it, can you explain to me what we mean by synthetic alcohol?
A lot of people actually say, well, alcohol is synthetic. Most of these cheap ciders... What are they? You know, they're just industrial alcohol with malic acid put in to make it taste of something like apple. That's real synthetic alcohol. What we're trying to do is find a synthetic alternative to alcohol, something that can turn on those parts of the brain that give you the good effects of alcohol, but by making a very specific and focused pharmacology, not get into the parts of the brain which do the bad things. You know, we want to minimize the risks of things like hangover, dependence, aggression, etc., which are mediated through different receptor systems in different parts of the brain. So the sophistication of the brain and the sophistication or the complexity of alcohol allows us to hone in on specific areas where it works and avoid the others. And that's what we're trying to do.
Right, I'm just hopping in to say that this is just one in a series of podcasts exploring the low and no alcohol sector. We're going to be looking at the trends and innovations hitting the market this year. So if you want to know which areas will be exploding in 2022, make sure you don't miss an episode throughout January. And keep your eye on the website, a treasure trove of everything food and drink industry related. It's at foodmatterslive.com. And now, back to the chat. Now, if you achieve this, then I would imagine you will swiftly be richer than Bezos, and that's a pretty good motivation for doing it. But what else is the motivation for this? I mean, this
oh, is- my motivation is no. I mean, I don't need. You know, I'm quite well off. I'm still getting paid by Imperial College. I've had a good life. You know, the motivation is I'm a doctor. Every doctor, every day, meets people who've suffered the consequences of alcohol. And the synthetic is something we've been developing in the last few years now. And we've tested molecules. We initially went out and looked for molecules that have already been made, and we found some, but they really were too challenging and too expensive. And the companies that had them didn't really want to be talking to us. They didn't believe in it. So now we've gone away and made our own molecules. We've invented molecules. We've tested some of them. We've got effects. And we're in the process of making a final decision as to which is going to be our lead molecule to take through food safety testing so that in a year or two we can have that available, assuming it passes all the tests. And we're raising in, we've got a new investment round coming up in February to pay for that, which is quite an expensive thing to do.
I can imagine, yeah.
But in the meantime, a few years ago, we thought, well, maybe nature's done this for us. Why don't we look in nature to see if we can find molecules which might serve the same purpose? And we spent a couple of years deep diving into the whole area of plant biochemistry, Ayurvedic medicine, Chinese medicine. And we discovered actually a lot of plants make GABA, and GABA seems to have some kind of role in plants that's kind of healing and protective as well. So, and they also make substances which can modify the effects of GABA. And there are plants out there which have been used for centuries as kind of healing or mood improving or calming plants. So we put together a botanical drink which comprised several of those herbs, which have obviously been around for a long time. So they're all considered sort of acceptable foods. Mix them together in a cocktail, which we call Sentia, which is, I think, the Italian for feeling, and then added in flavorings and one or two other agents to facilitate the effects of the plants. And we've made this, which is like a vermouth, really. It's a kind of complex vermouth that you can use as a base. And so now I just drink that in the week. I used to drink low alcohol vermouths, so like the martini ones. Now I drink Sentia with tonic in the week and just drink wine on Friday and Saturdays when I got a bit more time in the mornings to recover.
And any sense of a timescale for this?
So Sentia is available. Sorry, I should say it's been available this year. We're only selling it through mail order, largely because we're trying to scale up production. It's become quite popular, and we don't want to start pushing it out into the hotel and the bar market until we can supply the needs. So we're trying to find some facilities to make more of it, because it's quite a complex thing to do, because you're mixing multiple herbs together in a sort of 2-day process. But in terms of the synthetic, yes, well, food safety testing is an interesting challenge. No one has ever done this before. So there's no precedent. We know what the rules are. We know that there are European rules and we know that there are American rules. But of course, until you've done it, you can't be sure. So we're thinking probably 3 to 4 years But it might be less if there's a sort of positivity, if everything pans out and it turns out it does meet all the safety criteria, and we can get regulators to think that this is actually a good thing, then, you know, it might, you know, maybe it's, you know, going to be slightly less time. But I'm thinking 2 to 3 years. That's what investors will have to be. They're in it for quite a long ride.
Yeah. And what are the things that might be holding it back at the moment? I mean, is it cash? Because to be honest, if I was an investor with a multiple portfolio, I'd think, do you know what? This one, it might not work, but my God, if it works, it's going to be flipping huge.
Yes. Well, so yes, what we are saying to investors is, well, the alcoholic drinks market is £1 trillion. The non-alcoholic drink market's £1 trillion. We only need a small percentage of either to make it a rather profitable, a rather successful business. So, we're hoping, like you suggest, that investors will be rational and positive. It's a gamble, but it's the one area. This is probably the last disruptive technology. When you think about it, you've got vaping as disrupted cigarettes. You've got electric cars. You know, is there any other branch of life where we haven't had serious disruption other than drinking? Probably not. Yeah. So this is the last frontier, and we have actively refused to be taken over by any company, any drinks company, because we want to make available to all drinks companies this alternative. They can have it as an ingredient, and then they can make their own drinks. And that way we will get much broader entry into the market. People can drink Diageo-flavoured, Arcarel or, you know, Coors-flavoured Arcarel beer or whatever. You know, so that way I think we do everyone a service. The alcohol industry gets something new, which it kind of needs, really, because sales are pretty flat. And we get the population that want an alternative, you know, all around the world, rather than just in a few places we might be selling it.
Yeah. So let's just last couple of questions really for you. So we have a low and no alcohol drinks industry, which is it's expanding very rapidly, but it's still a tiny proportion of sales. Do you see a world in which at some point alcohol won't be there anymore?
Well, it's happened in Islamic countries, of course, in theory. So, no, I mean, getting rid of alcohol is not something anyone really wants to do, because it is something that gives most people pleasure most of the time. What I'm hoping, and it won't happen in my lifetime, is that if we provide an alternative that gives people what they want from alcohol, but with much, much less of what they don't want, then maybe 3 generations, 4 generations time, Arcarel, will be what people drink, and alcohol itself, traditional alcohol, will be reserved for special occasions or for special groups of people. I think we will see that. I think the fact that a lot of young people now are moving to low or no alcohol drinks, but then one of the problems is, you know, the current no alcohol drink market isn't actually that enjoyable. People are not getting drunk, but they're not getting what they want as well. So we're trying to, you know, fill in that gap between getting what you want and minimizing the harms.
Yeah. Now, my last couple of questions. Have you seen that the government or public health bodies helping you or wanting to get involved to promote alternatives to traditional alcohol, or are they just too confused at the concept of it all?
No, the answer to your question is very straightforwardly, not at present. No, people I think are still unclear as to whether it could happen and skeptical. And that's one of the reasons it's great to talk to you, because the public dialogue is so important. There's no way, even if we invented the best alternative to alcohol in the world, if people didn't want it and didn't know about it, or if people were misinformed about it, then it isn't going to go anywhere. So what we need to be doing is getting people to understand that science does give us this opportunity. And if we can create people's understanding of that, and also a desire to, an anticipation for it. And again, that's where the botanical does have a role, because people can see that it is possible. You can get an effect, like half a glass of wine from our botanical drink, which is for many people enough in order to get you over that threshold of conversing with old Aunt Ethel on a Christmas morning or something.
So I offer you the opportunity to give it a plug, mainly because I'd quite like to get myself a bottle and have a go. So where can you get Sentia from?
You get Sentia from the Sentia website. Type in Sentia and it goes straight to the website.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. I'm absolutely fascinated, and we've got to catch up again to find out how this evolves, because I think it's also incredibly important. David Nutt, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Stefan. I'm happy to have this conversation anytime you want it.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore the whole landscape of the food industry, from the ag tech boom to food security. Recent highlights have included episodes on the power of collagen and a look at the ag tech hotspots of the world. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.